All right, today on The Nose, the celebrity profile. We're going to talk about some specific celebrity profiles of late and about the genre itself. It has been suggested maybe it is a dying art, assuming it ever was an art. A little bit later in the show, we're going to talk about the new Netflix movie by Nicole Holofcener, which is called The Land of Steady Habits. It's sort of could also be called Mumblecore with Money. It takes place, at least allegedly, in Westport, and stars, as usual, as is the usual case with her films, a lot of really terrific actors. But does it add up to much? We'll talk about that. Joining us as the panel are Jim Chapdelaine, Emmy-winning musician, and you see, you have three more to go to get an EGOT. You got the E. Do you have to get them in order?
It's all. I'm never going to get an EGOT.
You could get a Grammy.
I'm a two-time Grammy loser.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm a four-time EGOT loser. I mean, I've lost. I have not ever won any of those. I don't know. I have never been nominated for any of them either. So I guess
I'm just trying to figure out, does that make me better than you?
Right. I think you are better than me. Jacques Lamar is a playwright. So you're probably going after the T in EGOT if you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a T.
Yeah, he wouldn't mind a T. He'd take a T. Senior project manager at Buzz Engine. Irene Papoulis teaches writing at Trinity College. At the beginning of the show these days, are going to also mention things that people want us to mention. So the Mark Twain House Writers Weekend is coming up. It's not this weekend. It's next weekend. Gary Stenegart is the keynote speaker, but all kinds of terrific writers will be there to teach you how to write. So think about that. Also, I want to do a quick plug, which is that my series, Freshly Squeezed, at Watkinson School, which Jim actually has been a panelist on, is launching on October 3rd, the first one we're going to do. And this is the thing. You go there at Watkinson School at night, and there's a lovely dinner beforehand, if you choose to ingest. And then you go into this lovely amphitheater, and there's an interesting conversation, and there's questions and answers. We're going to talk about civility. We're going to talk about, basically public decorum, specifically in political campaigns. After 2016, are we just sort of walking down a staircase, a rhetorical staircase into hell, or can we walk back up the stairs? Does it ever go in the good direction? Anyway, you might want to join us. I'll be announcing the panelists in a few days. All right, so it's time. We're going to move on to celebrity profiles. Where to start? Well, I guess maybe we should begin. We all read a profile of Chevy Chase, and that's sort of a jumping-off point for us. And it might be a good way to sort of begin pushing our way into the whole question of celebrity profiles. So this is a profile of Chevy Chase. It's conducted in his home, which I think is in Bedford, New York. It's by somebody who's really been kind of stalking him in a profile writing kind of way for quite some time. And it attempts it's Chevy Chase's attempt, I guess, or it's his opportunity to kind of correct the record about him as a guy, first of all, who in the past obviously has abused every substance in the world and sometimes has turned him into a highly unpleasant person. And Irene, I think the purpose of this profile is for Chevy Chase to have the opportunity to prove that he is a pleasant person. I don't know if that's a good enough reason to do a profile, but what did you make of it?
I can't say that he seemed pleasant.
No. I'm saying that was the purpose.
The purpose, but he seemed so I couldn't help feeling sympathetic to him and feeling like he was misunderstood. And he's just trying to be funny, and he's pushing against having to do things the way other people do them, and having to obey other people's rules. And so, since I admire that, I couldn't help admiring him to some extent. But I could imagine. But then I thought, yeah, but he kind of seems like really a mess,
right? But that gets to the question of, and anybody, go ahead and pounce on this. I'm not going to call on anybody. What is the purpose of the celebrity profile? Like, why do we read the? Why does anybody write them? Why do celebrities consent to them? Why do we read them? I mean, use this one or any one you choose. And why do they exist? Why celebrity profiles? I will call on somebody.
Well, I enjoy reading celebrity profiles, and I think part of this discussion is the jumping off or how they've become disappointing or overly managed by the stars or their handlers or what have you. But I mean, when I'm reading these things, I'm of course looking for greater insight into that person or something that I had no idea about. And of course, with something like the Chevy Chase thing, where it kind of it doesn't go off the rails, but he really kind of proves the point that he's trying to disprove about him being difficult. Yeah. Or
we should say a few words about this. I mean, one of the things he does, for example, is essentially disparage or damn with faint praise anybody who's been on Saturday Night Live after his, you know, 2 or 3 year reign on the show. I mean, in a way that really seems very ungenerous.
Or any he damns just about anyone that is in his radar.
Right. Anybody not named Chevy Chase.
Right.
It turns out that being Chevy Chase and you're not is like really kind of a more defining.
Much more literal thing than we ever imagined.
You took that thing way more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's go ahead.
Kind of,
whoever was talking.
Yeah. It's kind of what I want in a celebrity profile myself, because I guess I would say I want to get a glimpse of the person that, you know, I want to feel like there's a certain kind of intimacy that you get as a reader, like learn things about him that I wouldn't have ordinarily known and sort of get into his head a little bit. So in that sense, it's kind of satisfying to see him doing that. You know, it's not that I necessarily, do we read them because we want to like the person? I mean, sometimes we read them just because we want to see, like, wow, he really is as out there as people might have said, or you know, or I feel like I'm going to have an experience of him when I read the profile that is kind of interesting. Like, and so I did feel like I got into his head in that profile. They talked about his childhood and how his mother locked him in the closet and everything, and so I find that satisfying in a celebrity profile.
The mother part.
Yeah, to know that, because it's like, that explains a lot.
Well,
yeah.
I thought that was interesting because, okay, as somebody who has written magazine profiles myself, one of the things you do when you're working on a profile is you look for a key. People are essentially locked doors, and you look for a key that can maybe just get one of these doors a little bit ajar so you can get a little bit of light in there and find out something. I mean, it's not entirely a friendly process. You want them to tell you things that they theoretically anyway don't want to tell you. What's interesting about the Chevy Chase profile is he rejects the key, right? So it turns out that this book has been written about him. Various books have been written about him. But one book has been written about him, which accentuates this whole idea that he had this terrible mother who locked him in closets and did all this kind of, you know, all the same stuff that Sun Yi says that Mia Farrow did to her in her celebrity profile. But anyway, Chevy Chase rejects that, right? He says, that didn't do nothing to me. That's not who I – are you kidding me? And I mean, that's his argument, right?
Yeah, it is. And it's almost like trying to buy him license for being a jerk. Mm-hmm. So here's we're going to issue this and stamp this license for you because you've had some sort of trauma in your life that you're entitled now to go forward and be a jerk. I feel sort of disappointed. I was really sad when I read that because he started out as a physical absurdist sort of comedian. And he was really successful at that. And then he was going to transition into the big time. His talk show was horrifying. His ability to really do nuanced comedy just seemed to diminish, which made him probably angry. I don't know. But he just seems really sad. And I think his publicist maybe set this up like, here's one shot for you to clear the table and reset this thing and go out there as a smiling jack. And he's just not having it.
Right. And I sort of admired the fact that he basically said, I don't want your existential permission to be a jerk based on my childhood. Right. I'll be a jerk on my own terms. Yeah. Thank you very much.
But we learn more about him than he even knows that we learn, because we could learn something about what the writer was trying to get across, even if he rejects it. Because obviously there is a connection there between his childhood and his behavior. So
I don't think anybody doubts that except him.
Yeah, and his rejection of that narrative is part of the interest of the profile. So it's for us, it's not for him.
So Jacques, in a general way, I mean, one thing that I suggested as we were emailing about this is supply exceeds demand for this stuff. That, you know, there's like so much of it out there, not just in magazine profiles, but podcasts. You know, Mark Maron and Chris Hardwick and people like that, and these guys come on and they talk for 2 hours. And I'm reminded of a 30 Rock episode. I was telling Jonathan, our producer, about this. There was a 30 Rock episode where Tina Fey's character took a drug given to her by Alec Baldwin's character so that she could be calm on an airplane. And it gave her all kinds of other side effects, including hallucinations. And she began to hallucinate that the person sitting next to her was Oprah. And they actually had Oprah play herself in this hallucination. And so Tina Fey kept turning to her and going, one time I said summer camp and I kissed a girl and then she drowned. My work self hates my life, me. I think I might have eaten my twin in the womb, you know. And then, like, she sort of calms down and then she'll turn back back to Oprah and go, wait a minute, is this, almost as if she's about to vomit. She goes, here comes some more stuff, you know. And Jacques, I feel like that's kind of how celebrity culture works a lot, is everybody kind of wants to just puke up their stuff these days. And I feel I'm less and less eager to get any of it.
Well, it's interesting because I actually feel like so many of these celebrities, if you look at Vogue with the Beyonce issue, are so afraid now. So they do an entirely curated experience. They stop doing interviews because they're afraid of allowing anyone else to kind of put a spin on their thoughts and their words. And so you get people like Taylor Swift who, you know, won't do interviews. So when something like Quincy Jones interviews came out, and we talked about those when they did, it was part of it was, is this a train wreck or a breath of fresh air?
Right.
And, you know, I can't remember who he was speaking about, but Lil Wayne on, was it Dateline? They asked him, you know, some questions, and he gave, you know, an answer regarding Black Lives Matter that he, you know, instantly regretted and then turned it around and made it seem like, oh, well, you know, you guys pulled a fast one on me and walks. So to me, those are the interesting things where you're seeing someone being raw. Not necessarily you're seeing a train wreck, but I mean, I think like the Sunyi Previn interview in New York, which is quite lengthy, you know, is fascinating to me because it lifted the curtain on someone I didn't know well. I'd only really had glimpses of her in that documentary Wild Man Blues many years ago, and where you realize that she's a much stronger individual than you would have perceived. And even the little glimpses of Woody Allen in that interview are kind of fascinating to me, and how she treats him.
But did it lift the curtain, though? Because, I mean, we have such another story from the other side. Did you feel like that article really reflected Sunyi as she is?
Well, I mean, the thing is we in a lot of ways didn't really know so much about her. We only really heard the other voice or Woody Allen making denials. We, you know, the Pharaohs have no problem going public with their thoughts on Woody Allen and Sunyi Previn. So for her to have a forum where she could, you know, tell her side of the story.
That she's like a mature, interesting, sophisticated woman with kids and just, yeah.
Well, and like I had no idea that she really resented her upbringing. You know, right. that to me was fascinating because I mean, one of the kids, I think it was Moses.
Moses has been the person who has been most inclined to blow up the Mia Farrow version of things.
Yeah. And so to me, it was, you know, here's this woman who's been in the eye of a hurricane for over 20 years, and you're kind of hearing her voice. And so to me, that was, I would rather read that than Beyonce's thoughts on Beyonce.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, no, I thought that was pretty fascinating. And of course, Daphne Merkin herself, who wrote that profile, is a pretty interesting person. And maybe the best profile Daphne Merkin ever wrote was the one about herself. I don't know if everybody remembers
Depression.
But, well, yeah. No, I thought about the one about how she likes being spanked, which caused quite a stir at the time. But no, she's a really good writer. And I thought it was fascinating. And the world is divided up between people who believe the Mia Farrow version and people who believe the Woody Allen version. You know, and a lot of that probably conditions how you feel about this particular profile, too. But at least it was somebody who hadn't talked before.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, another example of this, Jim, and I'm singling you out for a specific reason, is, although maybe not that reason. But, okay, so one of the things we've had recently, there was the Quincy Jones thing where he just kind of talked crap about a lot of people and, you know, just, you know, but there was also more recently.
Took the lid off, I think.
But more recently, we've had Paul McCartney effectively telling GQ all the stuff that they didn't say. it was like, you know, celebrity profiles are kind of a lot of cards, most of which are face down, and which the celebrity elects or can be talked into maybe turning over one or two of them. Well, like decades later, Paul McCartney is effectively saying, here's some of the cards that we were keeping face down.
And they are quite the cards. I don't know that it's appropriate for a family show or any show
Google
or
it.
That he should have ever turned over that card.
Just but Google it if you haven't
At this
read
point
it.
In his life, I guess he doesn't care. But
no.
I wasn't quite sure what the point is.
Did you care? I mean, I sort of didn't even want to know this.
I did. I definitely didn't want to know.
Mm. Wow. But so what kind of things?
Google it.
Google
well, no,
it.
Yeah, let me put it to you this way. Once you read these disclosures about certain activities that the Beatles, in some cases, engaged in collaboratively.
As young boys together.
You will never listen to the song Come Together quite the same way again.
And you didn't want to know that? Didn't you want to sort of know that, though? I mean,
I would rather read that than, like, the profile of Maya Rudolph.
Okay, now we come to this. Oh, boy.
You're playing the Maya Rudolph profile card.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, that's a different story where the reporter gets in the way of what could be an interesting
Right. So
profile.
This was the cover story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine this past weekend. I'm a big Maya Rudolph fan, too. So, I mean, there aren't that many people I want to read a profile of. I mean, the New Yorker's very good at times of writing a profile of somebody that I barely ever heard of and I didn't know I wanted to know about. And that's really fascinating. But, you know, in terms of, like, really famous people, like, and it's a pretty short list probably. I think maybe you guys have your own, too. I'd love to hear. But Maya Rudolph is somebody I would like to read a profile of. Mm-hmm. But having read that profile, I don't feel like I've read a profile of Maya Rudolph.
Because you felt like the author inserted herself too much? Is that why?
I think the author almost exclusively.
To the exclusion of Maya Rudolph.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, Maya Rudolph was just like a prop, right?
The writer clearly had more things that she wanted to get off her chest than she had interest in Maya Rudolph's stuff.
Well, or she wanted to, she idolized her. I mean,
right.
You know, and so she wanted to explain why she idolized
because
her.
Of their many similarities.
Yeah.
But she also really wanted to use every word that she was aware of that existed in the most flowery way possible. I mean, the open alone.
The opening was
really
the worst part.
I kept reading. It was like, you know, every year they have that contest for like bad literature, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this felt like an entry at some level. Like, are you kidding?
She compared her to God.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Jacques, in some ways, it's a hard – I mean, something that's – one of the reasons we read profiles, I think. I mean, we might just read them because, you know, it's a profile of Cher. You really like Cher. You want to read about what – this is sort of a discarded topic. We talk a lot about Cher.
What you meant to say is you're saving it for a full episode.
Exactly. So – but so there's a profile of Cher. You want to know more about Cher because you really like Cher. So you'll read that profile. Okay. So that's kind of the most benign thing. But mostly I think we read profiles because we think they're either going to blow up in a really bad way – you know, like the Chevy Chase article is, I think, a pretty good example. Or because the profile writer is going to just take it to some kind of really interesting place that we haven't seen before, which is what a lot of profile writers are trying to do today, right? That you just somehow or other have to get people's attention because there is just so much clutter out there. The risk of that is, I mean, there's just a fine line between excellence and disaster. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are certain people, and I'm going to play my share card face up. Where you know – I've never seen her give a boring interview.
Mm-hmm.
It's like as many Cher profiles as there have been done over the, you know, what, 50 years of her career, she gives good interview. And it's
and
part
so what,
of
– And so what is it that she does, would you say?
She's unafraid.
Yes. I would agree with that.
She's fearless to be completely transparent about things. And that in such a guarded celebrity culture is so welcome. And I find her opinions on things to be
She's also really smart. Mm-hmm. She does get
smart.
Credit for that.
And so, you know, there are certain magazines, I think like Rolling Stone or whatever, that get into really insightful, interesting profiles. And then there are ones that, you know, promise something that they're just either the writer's not capable of delivering or what have you. But I mean, to me, it's, you know, it's always someone that I want to know more about. And if I feel like I've walked away being pandered to as a reader, it's disappointing.
But is there room for a genre where it's about me talking to Maya Rudolph, let's say, and that's an S?
I
mean,
think
I guess
so.
It has to, but it has to be an interesting person who's.
Wait, I think there's all kinds of ways to mess around with the genre, and it, you know, I mean, speaking of Rolling Stone, there are, as I pointed out before the show, actually two movies that are about Rolling Stone profiles. One of them is Almost Famous, which is about a fictional, non-existent profile, but it's about a young writer trying to write a profile of a rock band. And the other one is The End of the Tour, this fabulous movie. That it's about a real-life attempt by a profile writer from Rolling Stone named David Lipsky to do a profile of David Foster Wallace, which is also interesting because David Foster Wallace wrote some profiles himself besides being a novelist and probably is responsible for a lot of the experimentation that goes on now, people trying to write profiles in which they sort of break the model of profile writing. But I think done well, you know, and you teach writing and stuff. I mean, it could be really exciting if you do it the right way. You just, you know, as I'm sure you tell, what do you tell your students?
Yeah, I actually do tell them that because my students actually are writing a profile right now in one of my classes.
You didn't tell us this.
Yeah, no, but it's really interesting. And we're talking a lot about the balance between yourself and the subject. I mean, their subject aren't celebrities for the, you know, so maybe there's a little bit more room for themselves as the writer being interesting, but. You know, but I think it's so easy though so many people are afraid of sounding too egotistical. You know, I don't want to sound like the woman that wrote the profile of Maya Rudolph, so therefore I'm going to hold back too much. You know, so I kind of want the writer I don't want to object to that profile because it's not solely about Maya Rudolph. I'd rather. But I would object to how it's not about. I mean, the first opening and comparing her to God and sort of idolizing her, that does make it much less interesting because sort of like, wow, I'm actually in her presence. This is so amazing. I'm talking to her. When she was a child, she imagined herself as Maya Rudolph. And so then there's this passage where she's kind of imagining herself. Oh, yeah, that was when I was on Saturday Night Live as the writer, you know, which is kind of interesting in theory, but it the way it comes across is very, I think, very ineffective because you just sort of say, yeah, but you're not Maya Rudolph, you know, was kind of how I responded as a reader.
I'm just realizing that I've actually read a Jim Chapdelaine profile. You were profiled on the cover of some local magazine
and I believe it had some allusion to the band Yes, and I have no idea where any of that came from. So that sort of made me realize, like, when they don't have something, they'll make something up.
Right.
It just or they're pulling from the internet somewhere.
You mean you weren't in Yes?
No, but I have a Yes story, but I cannot tell it.
Yeah.
And I was not in the band.
Of Jim's best stories, unfortunately, cannot be told.
None
anywhere.
I will say to Irene's point about two people, there is the new David Letterman series on Netflix where he interviews a person equally interesting. There was one with him and Obama, and they light each other up. There's been several episodes. And so I think the format is there for something because it's a pretty fascinating series.
Right. I watched the Obama one and I hated it, and I haven't ever watched it since then.
Yeah,
but
why did you hate it?
Yeah.
I hated it because, and once again, this is like, you know, I mean, I interview people, so I thought he had no game plan whatsoever. And
I think that's the point, though.
Yeah, I guess I can't really admire that, though.
It's just like a conversation.
But it's like somebody who's not Brian Wilson starting to play a song that isn't in any particular key, you know, doesn't have a time signature.
Right.
You could be like Ornette Coleman or you can be Brian Wilson and get away with that. But for the most part, it doesn't work, you know, and I didn't think it worked with.
But what do you do if you're writing a profile?
I have first of all, if I'm interviewing somebody on the radio, which is more analogous to Letterman, I have a game plan. I have stuff I want to get to. I'm also trying to listen and be open to what the person says to see if there's an interesting place to go. If I'm writing a profile, what I have typically done in the past, I haven't done this in a long time, but I'm a big believer is in the whole idea that you have to stay around long enough so that the person kind of forgets who you are. You know, I mean, you have to like multiple visits and stuff like that so they get a comfort level with you. I will say that I did write a profile of a rock band. Maybe I won't say their name right now, although it wasn't a
bad. Was it Yes?
No, it wasn't Yes.
The answer is no.
No. Yeah. But at the end of it, I'll tell two quick stories about this. One of them was the last time I was with them, we were in the green room before they were going to go on stage up somewhere in like Northampton or someplace like that. And they said to me, Colin, you know, we've been having some conversations, and we really want to tell you that we really like you, and we like having you around and hanging around. I mean, by this time, I'd help them, like, load in their equipment for gigs. The
bands love that.
Yeah. And so they really like you, and we want to be friends with you after this process is over. Uh-oh. And I was thinking, yeah, well, we'll see. And then the profile ran. It was a magazine cover story. And I didn't hear from them, and I didn't hear from them, and I didn't hear from them. And then they said, they sent an email, and they said, we're going to play a gig in such and such a place. We'd like you to come, and see, we'd like to see you again and stuff. And so I went to the gig, and it was at a pretty big auditorium. And out in the parking lot, I ran into the lead guitarist, and he was bringing some stuff in. So once again, I helped him bring some stuff in. And he and I were walking side by side. He wasn't looking at me, and he didn't break stride. And he said, that was the most accurate thing anyone's ever written about us. And as such, the hardest to read. And to me, that sort of defines
writing. Right. That's best compliment.
Right. I mean, you know, if they feel like you haven't lied or made up a yes story, you know, but it wasn't like the greatest experience.
Right, right. And you're probably not hanging out with them.
Right. They didn't want to be your friend anymore.
But that's not your job. It's, right. it's not your job to hang out with
them. I'm not here to make friends.
That's right. Right.
In the words of Omarosa, or whoever actually first said that on reality?
Chevy Chase.
Well, there's that too.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure it was somebody on Survivor. Anyway, we have to take a quick break. I'm sorry for talking so much. I'm the host. I should shut up. So we're going to come back. We're going to talk about a Nicole Holofcener movie and maybe decide that's not how her name is pronounced. All right, so I have a funny feeling that the panel may be a little bit annoyed at me for thinking that this was a great movie for us to all watch. But
is that because we all started writing profiles about you immediately?
Well, no, I'm fine with that. I want to see the definitive profile of me. No, this is a movie called The Land of Steady Habits. How could I resist a movie called The Land of Steady Habits, which has been the nickname of our fair state for hundreds of years now? It allegedly takes place in Westport, although I'm told it was actually filmed in Tarrytown, New York. It is directed by Nicole Holofcener. She of many – I sort of feel like she's sort of a female mumblecore director, but she's directed some really interesting movies and always works with terrific actors. This is available. It's a Netflix original. We're going to hear the star here, Ben Mendelsohn, talking. He plays a kind of lost, recently divorced, recently early retired kind of Wall Street finance guy. He's talking to the son of a couple that he and his ex-wife were at least nominally friendly with, Charlie. And Charlie is somebody who's perhaps been using drugs a little bit too aggressively. So here are the two of them.
Okay. If you need anything, I've moved to the numbers on the back.
What happened to you? Like, quit your fancy job?
Oh, well, it's complicated, but yeah, I couldn't go on doing what I was doing to make a living and still feel good about myself.
I can totally respect that.
And it was complicated, you know, there were a lot of other things tied into it, like my wife and the endless commuting and just a lot of things. I couldn't take it, so yeah, something had to change.
To go to rehab now because my parents are Nazi.
They're worried about you.
They're embarrassed. There's a difference.
You did a stupid thing.
Seriously? I'm getting a lecture from you? You were high as balls.
I was tricked into that. And yeah, I'm sorry.
Guys, I'm joyful. I feel joyful.
Hey, I need you to keep that between us.
Don't worry, I'm not gonna tell anyone. It's not my style.
If you think maybe you recognize the voice of Charlie, he plays a similarly drug-consuming role on the wonderful Netflix series Ozark. All right. So we'll just start with like just your we actually didn't email about this movie. For all I know, you guys all loved it. But let's start over here with Irene.
I can't say. We were giving percentages of how much we liked it.
Okay.
And I would say like 65%. Mm-hmm. I liked it.
All right.
Tell
me more.
Yeah, because there are things that I didn't like it that are maybe more obvious, but I liked a certain kind of emotional truth about divorce and parenting, especially, that I thought was actually kind of interesting.
Right. To watch. Would you say that it was? I think one of these movies where the actual genre, which is to say the actual tone, is sometimes a little slippery to put your finger on. I mean, I considered it to be funny in certain places and not funny in other places, and kind of attempting to do both at the same time. I don't know. What was your take?
I agree. Even his acting at first, I thought, wait, is he just goofing on the whole thing, the main character? But then I thought, no, he's serious. And most of the scenes, he was serious. So, yeah, there were some funny things, though. Yeah. I think that was deliberate.
Yes.
But, yeah, so I don't know.
Jacques, give us your take. You can start with your percentage.
I was saying I kind of want to downgrade it a little bit, but I had said that I liked it 75%, but I'm gonna probably scooch to 70%.
You mean the elevator ride up here took 5% off?
No, the walk down the hall. I saw a bowl of Kit Kats and I got distracted. When the book came out in 2014 by the author Ted Thompson, I was working at the Twain House and saw the title of the book. And I was like, you know, we have to bring this guy here, which was really unusual for us to bring in a first-time novelist to talk about his book. But how, you know, like this discussion, how could we not? So actually, Irene led the conversation, and I liked the book. And
he was a nice guy.
Yeah, and a very nice guy, and I think a talented writer. And I would suggest people read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of saw and felt what the film was going for, and I wanted it to be a bit more like The Ice Storm or Far From Heaven or American Beauty, even these people of means who suddenly kind of have either chuck it aside or pull the veneer back.
But the first two that you mentioned commit more heavily to an essentially dramatic look.
Yeah.
I mean, Ice Storm and Far From Heaven are not funny movies in any way. You could argue that American Beauty, you know, once again,
there's
it's
a lot of humor
in American Beauty. But so maybe a little bit more similar to this.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. And I think for it, it doesn't feel overwhelmingly Connecticut, which for something that's called The Land of Steady Habits, I wanted to feel that a bit more. You know, I'm reading a new book by a friend, Ann Lineberger, called Sunday Best. And it's, you know, an exposure of people in a fictionalized version of Westport. And I think that there's that part of us that wants to see the ugliness behind the perfection. Mm-hmm. And I think that the main character Anders' decision to chuck the perfect home, the seemingly perfect marriage with a child and an enviable job, and have it go horribly wrong, to me is a story that I wanted to see and hear. So I think it delivered on it on the basics. I think the performances by the women in the film are really, really great.
Mm-hmm. We should say Edie Falco plays the wife of the lead character. The wonderful Elizabeth Marvel plays the mother of Charlie, the guy that you're
She's the best thing in it.
Well,
she's so terrific.
Elizabeth Marvel is in general. You know, she's going to be in that Glenda Jackson King Lear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's going to be one of the daughters, I assume.
I was like, it's Allison Janney. And
that's what
I'm
I thought
like,
of
No,
first.
It's not Allison Janney. And Connie Britton's great too, and so I think I was weighing, and I'm sorry, Jim. I know you're probably chomping at the bit to tear this apart.
He's constantly revising his percentage.
I don't know what to say anymore.
Yeah, but the other thing was I was sitting there watching it, going, if this was, you know, Catherine Keener and George Clooney in the same exact film, what I feel differently about it? Would it feel more elevated to me or something? So there's part of me that sort of wanted to feel like it was more of an important film rather than something that I'm going to forget, which is likely what's going to happen.
Right. We should say that the odds of you seeing Catherine Keener in a Nicole Holofcener movie are very high. I mean, most of her movies have had Catherine Keener in them, just not this one. All right. Time for you. First of all, percentage. We've got a 65 and a 70 right now. You could have
40.
Such 40.
40.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I mean, it's time I'm not getting back. And, you know, I was glad Jock referenced The Ice Storm because that's a movie that we still talk about. We still think about it. And that was a very Connecticut movie, but it transcended Connecticut. Yeah. This movie didn't – I feel – I also agree with his take on the female actors, which to me is where the money in this got spent wisely. But maybe they didn't have enough to make up for it with the other actors or a believable soundtrack or location audio, simple things that were disturbing to me that would throw me off. The music was just so generic, 90% of it, that it was. I felt like it was like a Hallmark film. More importantly, here's a guy who's really confused about his life. He's throwing it, and within seconds, he's in bed with a beautiful woman.
But that was funny.
Sure, it is funny, but then he's in bed with all kinds of women. It's like, what's attractive about this guy?
But it's like all you have to do isn't. I mean, it just seems like that happens all the time. You know, it's just like
you think that actually happens all the time?
Well, I first of all, another movie that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago because the lead died was Starting Over, which is very much. I mean, those exact words are said by Ben Mendelsohn in one of the early scenes. He says to a woman who sells in a decorative store. He explains that he's in a new house because he's – or a new condo because he's starting over. And that immediately – I think there's a jump cut from there to the two of them in bed. And there is this kind of thing where divorced, helpless, hapless-looking guys can sort of be really attractive to a certain kind of woman.
Isn't that called Match.com or something like that? I mean,
but I think
if you look helpless enough, you don't need Match.
I think that it illustrates – you know, like he thinks this is going to be part of the benefits of being the single man in this – later stage of
maybe
his life.
I think that's an interesting take on it, but maybe they just sort of rushed that one out. They sort of like, all right,
I think it was deliberately fast though, yeah. Because that's the funny thing about it is like people get divorced and they're like, I want to be with someone else. I have to be with someone else. So like, oh, here's somebody. And he's decorating. Okay, boom. And then
we should
bed.
Say also, and this is not a spoiler because it's the first 10 minutes of the movie. Yeah. So, but he's impotent in these bed encounters. I mean, they don't go well at all. I mean, they're not.
Right,
they're
so it's not even like, oh, great, I'm living the life, I'm enjoying sex or anything. It's more just, okay, well, whatever. Yeah, let's do that now. Kind of, and that's what I thought was funny.
I would sort of also tie this. One of the things that I find myself thinking. So I should say, Nicole Holofcener, who directed Enough Said, the Gandolfini, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Which I liked
Catherine
a lot.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good movie. And some of her other movies, like Please Give, which also has Catherine Keener in it, and Oliver Platt, are kind of interesting stabs at something. This movie, to me, first of all, it looked like it had more money in it than any Nicole Holofcener movie I've ever seen, but it was worse. And it reminded me of some of the more, speaking of Ben Mendelsohn in bed, more flaccid Woody Allen movies, the Woody Allen movies that aren't good. You know, he gets a lot of really good actors together, and there's a script that's not really all that funny, but it's not like all that interesting at a serious level either, and it just kind of sits there in front of you. And to me, this was a little bit of that.
It didn't really know what it wanted to be, I think.
Right, and I think I sort of felt like the message that it wanted to get across about our relationship to work and the way people parent their kids and the way people have an agenda, like that. Just even in that clip that we heard, he said, you know, they're embarrassed. They're not concerned with me. They're more embarrassed. The child says, you know, my parents don't want me to be messed up because of how it affects them, you know, which is an interest and the film sort of wants to critique that, but then it doesn't really, I wonder what it's really offering us in place of that.
All right. So I'll just play another quick clip here just because you mentioned this. We once again hear the Ben Mendelsohn lead character, Anders, this time once again talking to Charlie. This time he's talking about his own son. His own son is played by the young actor Thomas Mann, is also in this movie, also having problems, maybe not as bad problems as Charlie is having. And so Anders is talking about what kind of parent he was.
Because when he was a kid, he had this big, floppy bear. It was like a big, saggy bear. And he carried it everywhere, and I mean everywhere, and he held on to that thing. He held on to that thing way too long, way past the time when anyone's supposed to be hanging on to a bear, you know. So we took it off, and we hid it, and we pretended that it was lost. Because we were, I don't know, we were worried about him being teased, or that he wouldn't grow up, or some I don't know. Oh God, he was so betrayed. We betrayed him. He was devastated. He was heartbroken. What a stupid thing to be a parent.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be.
I feel like you guys all think that you have to, like, worry all the time. Like, if you weren't constantly worrying, like, your bad parents or something. What is that?
You know what? I'm going to take you home.
All right. So, first of all, Jim, there's that soundtrack.
I was just thinking as it's going, it's like there's a kid, low budget, he's just sitting in a room.
The keyboard
calls up.
I would like to point out there was a lot more swearing than you get in your average Hallmark film.
That's right. True. This is not after school special.
Right. Yes. Actually, the wife of the producer of this episode described it as a YA movie, but for adults,
which I thought was great.
That's yeah, really
and
great.
I also mentioned that this movie is one of the specific reasons that there's so many comic book movies that we deserve what we get.
I feel as a parent, like that moment of saying, like, why did I take, not that I ever would have done that, but something equivalent that I probably did, why did I take that bear away, let's say, if one did? You know, there's just something, or, you know, maybe even if I think about as a child, the things my parents did to me, like, even though I want to say, like, oh my gosh, it's so saccharine in a way, but at the same time, the emotion behind that, I think, is kind of
It feels to
poignant.
Me like luxurious worry, like the worried well.
Right.
Like they get to worry about that because they don't have to worry about money. They don't
it's
have to worry about
problems.
All these other
yes.
wafers. Like
but,
first upon
but
first.
But at that point, he,
but sure.
Does that
yeah.
mean they're not allowed to worry about?
No.
You know?
No.
But at that point, he's not wealthy. He's, you know, what he thought was going to be this great future for himself if he just gets divorced and strikes out on his own, everything gets undermined.
Well, he's not wealthy the way Bob Stefanowski isn't as wealthy as David Stummerman and Nick Lamont, which is sort of, it's all a gradient here. I think we do have to stop just so there'll be time for some kind of endorsements, so let's do that. And when we come back, we will endorse. The movie, by the way, is The Land of Steady Habits. It's on Netflix. You may or may not want to see it. When you're with your baby, let's go in a bag.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants, with help from me, Kyone Wolfe, and Betsy Kaplan. The part of Phil Curry was played by Catherine Keener. On Monday, we revisit our conversation about rust, then on Tuesday, our conversation about fire. And now, back to Colin.
And we are back to the nose. Irene Papoulis, Jacques Lamar, Jim Chapdelaine, all here to make some endorsements. So am I. We're on a somewhat tight clock here, but let's hear what you've got to endorse. Jacques, you want to go first?
Sure. First, I want to endorse the play that's currently running at the Hole in the Wall Theater in New Britain. It is a brand new comedy by a Connecticut playwright, which I always support, Scott Kegler's play, Final Arrangements, and it is truly hilarious. So if you get a chance to see it, I think it's running two more weekends, but it's very, very funny. And then the other thing that I would endorse came out just today. It's a 35-minute listen, but it's Prince's Piano and a Microphone, 1983. It's one of the first releases from his vault, and it was a single-take tape cassette of him at the piano. And so you're hearing him, his little studio talking, but you're hearing sketches of things that would later become Purple Rain. You're hearing some stuff that would come out years later, and also covers of like Joni Mitchell's Case of You, and it's really a kind of a revealing look at him right before Purple Rain came out. So you're getting him in this kind of raw state, but also where you can kind of see his genius with the piano. So.
Good endorsement. Yeah. By the way, his actual finished cover of A Case of You is an amazing cover version, too. Irene, what have you got for us?
I want to say a word for oversharing by women, because I think that it's much easier to criticize women for oversharing than not.
That's
to.
Not like, that's and, like the idea, not a fragrance or something like that.
No. That would be good. No, but there's this. So speaking of celebrity profiles, there's this author named Taffy Broadusser Ackner who's written two pieces in the New York Times recently, one about Gwyneth Paltrow mm-hmm. and one about Ethan Hawke. She also wrote about Antonio Banderas, and she does bring her own story in, but in a way that I think is much more artful than the woman about the other one, the one we were talking about. And I think I learned a lot about her by reading her talking about other people, and I might have mixed feelings, but I think she's an interesting writer. And also, there's a podcast called Mueller, She Wrote, which is about Mueller, but it's these women. One of them works in the White House, but she doesn't tell us her name. And they just sit around, these three women sitting around. And at first I was like, oh, they're telling us a little too much about themselves. But then I realized they really have a lot of information.
Is it about Robert Mueller?
It's about Robert Mueller.
Okay.
Mueller, She Wrote. Okay. Yeah. And it's actually, it's a very, I think, and yeah, there's a lot. It's an interesting podcast. Yeah.
I'll second the Gwyneth Paltrow profile. I'm still mad that we didn't talk about it on the notes. It would have been a great conversation. Jim Chapdelaine.
I'm realizing as I look at my endorsements, why I might not have been as receptive to the movie as you guys were. So I'm endorsing Fear by Bob Woodward, which you guys put a nice thing together with, I think, the day after it came out. And thank you for not revealing the end.
Right.
It's terrifying.
We all die.
Yeah, I think so, right? Yeah. So and then there's a piece in the failing New York Times that's a schematic of the entire Russian influence thing.
Yes.
And it sort of puts it right out there for you to see it. And so it's helpful. You can see the world that I live in. So I've been so stressed by all this that somebody recommended this little app called Headspace. And it's like a 5-minute meditation every morning. And this British guy named Andy welcomes you to the day. And he's really pleasant. And we do some breathing. And it's nice. And then I'll recommend after that whiskey.
Yeah. When you were starting out, I thought, oh, no, he's been using PCP again. That's why he didn't like the movie. But all right. So, Wolfie, you can even bring up the music now anyway because it starts at 56. Okay, perfect. So I'm going to begin by also recommending a play. It's Make Believe at Hartford Stage. It is a very risky play. It's young children playing young children who are in a terrible situation vis-a-vis their horrible parents who make the parents in the land of steady habits look like model parents. So, but it's the kids are terrific, and then you see their adult counterparts in the second half of the play. It is at times very funny. It is at other times very painful. These kids, I don't know how they got these kids to do these performances because they're just like amazing performances. Anyway, I really like this play, and I've been very grumpy about plays lately, so I was very happy to write to like a play so much. And then a group I discovered this week, they're called Beta Radio. They've got a new album out called, I believe, Ancient Transitions. And they're playing in the background right now. I'm going to shut up and let them sing at the end. It turns out they're from Wilmington, which is like underwater right now. Wilmington, which has been turned into an island temporarily by the hurricane. That has nothing to do with the fact that their new album just dropped. And they're terrific. And I'd rather let them sing. But listen to the whole album. It's an album. It's an album that you should listen to the whole thing, not just cuts. All at once I saw it all. Ghost parade a shroud, my body rearranged. All at once I saw it all, the pre-dawn in the canyon, the only place where I feel sure. All at once I saw it all, I'm sick for post-oblivion, where I want.